Hi, it's John Kirwan here. Welcome you back to Open Minded. This podcast isn't just a conversation, it's a deep dive into helping you feel better and perform better in both your personal life and the workplace. Each episode will feature conversations with extraordinary individuals from various fields. Together, we'll inspire you and share strategies on how to elevate performance and care for yourself and your team. We'll hear real-life stories from experts, business leaders, and community advocates on how they maintain high performance and take care of themselves under pressure, recover from setbacks, and get the right balance of lifting people and performance. So this is JK bringing you Open Minded. Let's dive in. Well, welcome everybody. Welcome back to the Open Minded podcast. Today, my guest is Kirsten Patterson. Her and I go way back, but she is the CEO of the Institute of Directors. I'm incredibly excited about this conversation because I think there's a perception of what boards and directors should be doing. I've been on a couple of myself and I'm going to bring a bit of experience questions for Kirsten. So welcome, Kirsten. It's a real pleasure to have you join us today. You know, I just want to sort of cover a whole lot of different things today. You know what I'm like, I've got a bit of a monkey brain, but maybe just start with a quick intro about where you are now in your past, because you've had a really interesting journey to get where you are.
Yeah, fantastic. Kia ora, everyone. My name's Kirsten Patterson, but everyone calls me KP. And that's kind of a hangover from the almost 10 years that I spent working at the New Zealand Rugby Union. So when you were deemed to have officially made the team at New Zealand Rugby, you were given an official nickname that went onto the induction list. And very unoriginal, both of us ended up, JK, with our initials, basically named after the initials that they put onto your laundry, onto your washing, to make sure that you get the right shorts back when your stuff goes into the kind of team washing. So kind of 20 mumble years later, I still get called KP. It's sort of a hangover from that. So yeah, I've from my time at rugby then moved on to working in chief executive roles in professional bodies, firstly for chartered accountants, and now 7 years with the Institute of Directors. And it's a great role. I really love what the IOD does. Well, we're the membership body that supports directors to do a great job. We genuinely believe that good governance is achieved through better businesses and better communities, and that'll make for a strong and prosperous New Zealand. And we get to work with 10,500 directors right across NZX listed boards, school boards of trustees, sports organisations, charities, family-owned businesses, and everything in between. So it really is a privilege.
I think we get used to this in New Zealand a wee bit, but you know, women in directors' roles, board roles. But back then when you were at the rugby union, you won some awards as being an influential, you know, woman in rugby. Yeah. It must have been an interesting journey for you. I mean, I'm brought up by three sisters, so I don't really see the difference between male and female. For me, it's always been, you know, four strong women in the house and me and dad.
Yeah.
So how was that back in the day? And what is the growth you've seen around, you know, the inclusion and diversity?
It's just been massive, and it's such a huge joy to me to have actually seen that journey over the last 20 years. So when I was recruited into rugby, I was recruited in by the now Dame Therese Walsh. She was the only woman in the executive team. And then when Therese left to run a Rugby World Cup 2011, I took her role. So then was, again, still the only woman in the executive team. And, you know, I had both my kids at rugby. So, you know, I took parental leave. I found an incredibly supportive environment. Steve Chu, who was my CEO at that point, bought me a little fridge I still have under my desk to this day, or breast milk, because there was only two fridges at rugby. There was a beer fridge.
And a
milk fridge, right? So, you know, so breast milk was kind of like, well, like, where are we going to put this?
Can't put that in the beer fridge.
So it was such, you know, I thought that was a really amazing kind of recognition from him, that actually here's something that, you know, I want to support you as a working mum coming back to work with everything that goes with that, and recognizing the whole person. And, you know, and I see the huge achievement in terms of how far they've moved on diversity and inclusion. And we all know that there's now a female chair. They've got a number of female directors. And I was involved in writing and leading the development of New Zealand Rugby's first woman in rugby strategy, not because I had any rugby knowledge, but because I was the most senior woman. And one of the things that I'm really proud of is, you know, getting that embedded into the community rugby team. I couldn't get it into professional rugby at that stage. You know, women's rugby was seen as a community initiative. And then actually getting that embedded now and seeing now where that kind of strategies come through. And it was during my time at rugby that I got really interested in strategy and in seeing where boards can make a difference, and actually also where you can use the power of the brand or the organization that you're in to have a voice and to bring a, you know, to bring a voice to issues that matter. And that kind of sort of set me on the trajectory. So I'm incredibly, you know, thankful for the time I had there. You hope you leave it better than you found it, but still recognize it's still got some way to go.
And that sort of leads to me to my first question, because I'm, diversity, inclusion, females on your boards, that sort of stuff. What, if you wrote the paper about this, what would you suggest to boards about why they should do it? I mean, one thing I hate is a box ticking exercise where you go, oh, well, I often quote Chantal Thompson, who's done some work with us. She's an Aboriginal woman and just this incredible person. I said to her once, what is it? And she said, JK, just put us on your boards. You've got to have an Aboriginal person on your board if you want to make change. And I think that was just, oh, okay, I get it now. Was that how you started with your writing strategy around diversity and inclusion?
Look, I think it depends on the different audience, right? Like, if we think about how diverse we are as people and the way our brains work and how we all learn differently, actually, if I'm writing a story or an article to try and convince you about the benefits of diversity, I will write that differently for different audiences, right? So, for some people, they will get that from a perspective of here. About fairness, about equity. Some people will get it from a position of brand, of recognizing your customers and wanting to be reflective of who your customers are, to understand and be reflective of who your employees are and wanting to connect with them. And having diversity means that you'll do a better job of being able to understand them, or you'll do a better job of being able to sell them. You know, and then for others, it'll be up here. They'll get it intellectually because actually they've now got a report on that, or stakeholders expect that. Or I can show them all of the metrics that show diversity is good for business, no matter how you measure it, right? So it will lead to better staff engagement, which means that you will have lower turnover, which means that you'll have lower costs. You're going to get better discretionary effort. We know that it leads to stickier customers, and you get better customer retention and attraction and acquisition. We know that it leads to better decision making at board level about risks. Boards that are more diverse have a better history of managing risks and innovation. So, you know, all of the things that we think about, the complexities that we're facing in our businesses and how society is shifting, diversity is a huge and important part of that. And it's not about, as you say, a box ticking. And we don't want to get to Noah's Ark where we kind of go, we want two of that and two of that and two of everything else. Because when we do that, actually, it is just box ticking. We're not unlocking the inclusion part of diversity. It's not just about the numbers, it's about how do we actually get an environment where everyone can participate fully. And that is tricky and it is hard. And I often get people saying to me, oh, but diversity is hard. It used to be so much easier. We could just make decisions so much more quickly and everything takes longer. Yeah, it does, but we're getting better decisions. So it's definitely worth the time.
So, I think there's a perception, and I could be completely wrong, of most people about boards and directorships and those boards and what the roles and responsibilities are. I put myself forward for a board and I have a charity which I'm leader of the board. But just explain to me, if I have no knowledge and I'm about to step towards this, what are some of the most important things you should be looking at? Because I didn't do this, and it was a hell of a shock for me, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole reason that we have a board in the first place is to rep the broader view. If we thought that one person had all of the perfect answers and could run everything by themselves, then we'd just hire a really awesome CEO and leave them to it. But we do recognize, of course, that you do need to have other supervising adults around. You need some people who are checking on the CEO, who are there to provide coaching and mentoring. They're testing, they're holding them to account. And that was also working, you know, well, everyone's heard that term, kind of working on the business, not in it, where they're actually out looking towards the horizon and not caught up in the day-to-day. And that's kind of why we sort of want a board. And we wanted to, again, unlock the diversity. We want to get somebody who's a chartered accountant or has got some legal skills, you know, we've got someone operationally, someone from marketing, someone who understands people, like all of the different skills together and bring together a team. It's one of the things I really loved about my time at rugby is that it's one of the few sports where there is a place on the field for nearly every single body type. If you think about what does a basketball player look like, then people will give you know, tall and lanky. We're actually in rugby, there is a role for everybody in the team, and governance is the same. There is a role for all of the skill sets around the table. But if you are thinking about getting into governance, there's some real kind of basic due diligence things you should be thinking about because there is not only your personal brand and reputation at risk, but also there are real legal duties and responsibilities. Now, if I have a bad day at work as a CEO, I can lose my job, I can get fired, right? But that's recoverable, I can go and find another job. But if you're a director and you make the wrong decision, you don't follow the rules and you get caught, or someone gets harmed at work from health and safety and you are responsible, then you are personally liable as well. So, you know, you can lose your house, you can get sued, you can go to jail. There aren't many jobs where that is the case. So people kind of do need to step into it really carefully, do some due diligence, not only about the organization and about how financially stable it is and, you know, and is it a good ethical business to be involved in or a good ethical organizational charity, but also the people you're serving alongside. Who else is going to be on that team and who else is going to be serving alongside you? That's really critical.
I thought that was really interesting that you mentioned the board's responsibilities, and I wrote them down: a coaching mentor, someone to control, someone to make sure that you see the diversity within your business. Are there, so when you pick a board, the ideal board, would that be, so there might be someone who mentors and someone else might be a little bit harder on the CEO. Do you try and get that mix around the table?
I think you should. Absolutely. You know, you want to be supportive of your CEO, but also you can't be best friends, right? You know, and so, you know, you've got to have that a little slight element of tension kind of in there. That it's very much like that kind of coach. You know, the coach could drop you. So, you know, you've got to have that kind of element in there, but you do need to have the different, I guess, like in the 80s or 90s, we'd say De Bono's hats, right? All the different kind of colored hats. And you've got to have somebody who's a creative hat wearer and somebody who's a bit of a black hat wearer and looking at those different things. Now, like all of our strengths, if you overuse them, they become a weakness. So I'm not sure that I'd like someone using their black hat all day, every day, you know, because, you know, you do need to be able to sort of progress things a bit more positively sometimes. But you do need to have a little bit of that tension and different diversity of approach and different thinking styles in the room so that you can truly unlock risk and opportunity, because that's what boards are focused on, right? They look at strategy, risk, and opportunity. So, and the best way to do that is with a really interesting group of people.
There seems to be two different types of board, and I could be completely wrong. So this is JK's ignorant question. So, for example, if I look at the NZR board right now, it seems to be different to what a Fletcher's Challenge board might be. Are there different things that you need to be aware of when you're taking on a certain role? Like, is there higher governance? Like, for example, how would I explain this? Like, the CEO of Fletcher's would be front and foremost the person that's sort of, you know, leading the organization. But when you come to some things like NZR, then sometimes it's often someone like Dame Patsy who's leading in it, and the CEO role seems to be very different. Is that true, or is that just my perception?
I think it's a reflection of the different industry types, right? So, I mean, firstly, there's a really easy way to carbon date in our time at rugby, right? Because you slipped into NZRFU.
I know,
I
yeah.
called it the NZRU, and of course, the NZR now. Like, you know, it's just kind of funny how, you know, sort of how the, and I think that's a sign of how things evolve, right? And so, and it's also a sign of just the number of stakeholders that a beast like New Zealand rugby really has. It's a bit like Air New Zealand, right? We all feel that we own it, even if we're not a shareholder in it. So if you look at different boards and different places need to have a kind of a different skill set, or they'll have at a particular season, it's making sure you've got the right captain for the right season. And so sometimes you will have the chair out the front a little bit more because they're dealing with a bit more stakeholder governance, kind of issues, or sometimes you'll have the CEO out the front because it's actually an organizational issue or an operational issue. So, organizations kind of have to make that slight decision. But when we look at the New Zealand context, we have so many co-ops in New Zealand, so many, community-owned or shareholder-owned organizations, whether that's like Fonterra or like New Zealand Rugby, those kind of incorporated societies or co-ops that are collectively held, not just by people who sort of own shares in them. And the minute you do that, then all of a sudden the stakeholder base is much more complex for an organization to manage. And the board should reflect what your strategy of your organization is. So if you're a co-op and you've got owner operators, then you need to have that reflected on your board because they are the decision makers, they are the influencers, they understand the business really deeply. If you're a Fletcher's board, then you're going to want someone from construction, you're going to want to have legal skills, going to have someone who deeply understands the accounting standards and all of those things. So it's making sure that your board reflects, the season and the type of business. And, boards aren't generic. You can't sort of cut and paste people and move them across. Some people are great in some boards, but they're terrible in others. It all comes down to that team, that particular environment.
If I'm on a board, and this is so me, like I don't read a lot, right? Can I rely on the other, like if I'm around a board and I'm there for my creativity or ideas or whatever, is it okay that I leave some of the more serious governance lawyer stuff to the lawyers sitting around the room? How do you divide that work up so that you're not liable? How does that work? Or you've just
Well, yeah, you can't divide it up so you're not liable. We're all responsible. And so that's why it's really important you've got good confidence in the people that you're serving alongside because they hold your reputation with their reputation. And you can't sort of go, okay, well, I'm leaning out of this and I'm not going to be responsible for this part. But what you can do is you can get them to lean in more on the bits where they're the specialist. So, like for me, I'm a bit like you. Working on a bank board might not suit me because it's 1200 pages of reading every month and a whole pile of numbers. And I used to say I went to law school because I couldn't count, right? So that wouldn't probably be the best environment for me. But there are other environments where I can lean in, and as long as we kind of, but we all need to understand the finances, we all need to understand the balance sheet, we all need to understand what's going on, but you can let the specialists lean in a bit more on those bits. So, and that comes down to thinking about where's your skills best placed for the right organization. And then it's about applying your skills in a really diligent way. Too often we get people sort of going, oh, I'll just join a board or I'll join a not-for-profit because, they've asked me to, it seems like a good thing to do, but I'm a bit busy and they don't dedicate the time properly. But as long as you're doing your best, making good, reading the papers, but you don't have to be able to, read them 50 times, but, read the material that's presented and asking good questions. Because some of us do think in different ways. Some of us, like to stand up and stretch our legs. Some of us like to ask questions and learn through engaging with people around us. And it doesn't all have to be done in these kind of boardrooms sitting at tables wearing ties. That's not what governance is about.
Am I right in assuming that governments now are putting a lot more responsibility onto boards to be way more diligent around some of the things that possibly, what's the best way to put it, they can't afford? And obviously, I'm coming from a mental health background. I think there's old. So we're seeing, in Victoria, mental health going into the Health and Safety Act. Do you see the responsibility of governing some of the things that in the old days, we might thought would be government driven, more and more on put onto boards?
We've seen a huge shift of that, and some of that's not a bad thing. So, I think there is an appropriate level, and health and safety is a great one, and we can talk about that in a little bit more detail and how, that really became a focus for directors in 2015 when all of a sudden they were personally liable, and New Zealand's health and safety statistics are just not okay, right? And kind of again, we're behind Australia, and none of us like to be behind Australia on anything, right? So it's just like on nothing else, just on sort of on pure kind of national pride. Let's sort that out, quite apart from the impact it's having on families. So, so there's an issue there. But what we are seeing is quite a big shift, I think. It's a societal shift as much as it is a government shift. Chicken and egg, who started it, is debatable, because government responds to societal shifts and society change to what changes to what government's doing. But we are seeing this kind of expectation that businesses or companies will be responsible for more. And some of that's actually because they're also our most trusted entities now. So the Edelman Trust Barometer is done globally and consistently around the world. The most trusted entities now is not government, and it's not our NGOs, it's businesses. So we as consumers trust our businesses more than we trust our governments. So we are looking to our employers for to care for us more. We are expecting them to create environments that are safe to work in and that do think about our mental health and psychosocial, safety in our businesses. Whereas 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't have those conversations. We still had that need, we just weren't talking about it. So I don't know how much of the need has changed. I think actually we're actually just recognizing the impact of some of these things on humans and on our communities, and recognizing that we're getting better at saying, hey, we've got to do something about this. How do we do that? Let's structure that in a way where most of us spend a lot of our time at work, right? So, who's responsible? It's hard to separate, work and life these days. A lot of that pressure is going into the workplace.
There is no work-life balance, there's life. And I think technology has accelerated past us. And I often talk about we get more inputs on a day-to-day than our grandparents had in a lifetime. So we've got to start taking some of that control back on how we look after our, what I'm sort of talking, performance care. Before we get on to that, so how would you say to a group of boards or directors, how do they foster a culture of integrity and accountability within organizations? So here's the other perception that I had was wrong when I went first on my board. Oh, yeah, I'm going to sit there, and then the CEO is going to go and do what we have sort of spoken about. But how would you, if you're on a board, make sure that what you're the people like the CEOs really understand that, hey, I am responsible here, so I'm going to have a voice, and you need to try and create an opportunity of agree to disagree, but then it needs to be implemented, right? So we had a pretty high profile, board with one of our industries get taken to court. So that's probably extreme, but how do you know that it's getting executed as you want it?
It all comes down to good questions, right? So, like, so much of how to change human behavior is the same as how you change organizational behavior, because organizations are made up of humans, right? So we often talk about, the company or these brand names, but actually companies are made up of people every day making decisions, turning up to work and making choices about how they will operate or how they will behave. So the same way that we change ourselves and change people around us in terms of good coaching conversations and asking the right questions, holding to account, following up, asking for reporting, trust but verify, right? So show me. How do I know that to be true? And that's where boards really can add that value. Not reporting for reporting's sake, because that's frustrating for boards, it's frustrating for management. And it actually, as we will have seen from, like, again, some of those health and safety statistics, reporting on the number of, high-vis vests and bloody steel cap boots is not changing our health and safety statistics. So some of those kind of lag factors, there's a hygiene factor with those, we've got to have them. But so thinking about what are the actual true measures and things about what's going to flow through. And then it's that the continual digging into those questions. And one of the areas is those unintended consequences. If we think about things, oh, you may have heard about the Banking Commission in Australia a couple of years ago, really big news. There was some really big examples of poor consumer outcomes from the banks in Australia, and a Royal Commission followed from there. And they were unintended consequences. Some of the things that the boards were setting about, thinking they were good ideas about sales targets, for example, and the way that they were remunerating sales targets. You know, if you sell this, you'll get a trip to Fiji. If you sell this, you'll get an iPad. Those sorts of things were trickling down through the organization, and with the pressure to respond, pressure to perform, only measuring the sort of sales outcomes without measuring the customer outcomes meant that people were being sold banking or insurance products that they should never have been sold, that didn't fit their needs, and that they couldn't afford, right? So it's those kind of things that at a board level, on one level, you go, oh, I'll just measure sales targets. You've got to think deeper, and you've got to do those coaching questions and get the whole picture. And that's the benefit of the board, you know, because within teams, we get caught. If you're in the sales team, you're going to focus on your sales, right? But somebody's got to be thinking about the culture and thinking about the customers and bringing those bits of information together. That's where the board can go, hang on a minute, there's a disconnect here. We're getting some poor outcomes. And that's where they've got to ask those questions.
A pretty serious downfall after that too. If you watch anything in America, that's pretty much what happened with the last financial meltdown, right? So, what are the key challenges you're currently seeing for boards in general?
So I'll kind of go through the top five issues that we've sort of identified, but at a high level, everything's a governance issue if you think about it deeply enough, right? Whether it is diversity or the gender pay gap or the economic conditions or, you know, the war with Russia and Ukraine and the impact that that's having on geopolitical risks or on supply chain. So, you know, so that depending upon your business, there'll be lots of different angles. One of the roles I also hold with the IOD is I'm chair of the Global Network of Directors Institutes, and that is the all of the IODs around the world. So as a result of that, I get to see what's happening in governance across lots of different countries and get to kind of see all the threads and the themes. The really interesting thing, the number one issue keeping directors awake around the world, in the US and Canada and Singapore and Australia and the UK, South Africa, Malaysia, etc., cybersecurity, right? So how do we keep ourselves safe? Interestingly, here in New Zealand, it's not even in our top three. So what's different? Why do we feel so safe and secure down here?
One of our banks just said they're going to spend $100 million on cybersecurity.
Our bigger organizations, banking and finance sector, it's their number one. Absolutely their number one. But generally, here in New Zealand, where a lot of SME business owners, small, medium-sized enterprises, they don't have, you know, cybersecurity experts. They're not big enough to have even IT teams some of the time. So, we're very reliant on offshore providers and those sorts of things. So if you know, if you're on a board or an advisory board of, you know, not-for-profit or a smaller entity, thinking about things like, okay, well, how do we do cyber in a way that we can afford or in the best way possible? Those are some of the things that are really critical. The top five issues for directors for this year that we identify, top five things for them to focus on, always against this bottom layer, though, of good health and safety, good financial management, and good ethical practice. Those ones don't change. But the top five kind of topical issues for this year. First one, climate leadership, really critical. So, you know, it's been on our list for a number of years, but climate change is not changing in terms of our behaviours quick enough. So we do a lot of work in trying to get climate to be a priority for directors. The second issue is around future-ready succession. So we've got changing demographics here in New Zealand. Our markets are changing. Our employees are changing. How are we ready? How are we going to be really attractive employers for Māori and Pacific and Asian youth coming into our organizations if, you know, everyone looks like us, JK, you know, and the management
With
teams
the
and, you
last
know,
point.
how are we going to kind of change our leadership teams and our boards to respond to that? The third is harnessing AI, right? And we've said harnessing because it kind of gives you this image of having to kind of, you know, get this kind of stallion under control or at least be able to kind of stay connected to it. So, you know, how are we as businesses preparing for AI and what it could mean? And what does that mean from a perspective of ethics and privacy? The fourth issue is around productivity. New Zealand has a much lower level of productivity than the countries that we like to compare ourselves against. And that's going to require research and development investment. We can't just keep throwing more and more entry-level labour and think that that's going to be the way that we can grow our businesses, because that's not how we grow wealth in New Zealand for everybody. We need to make sure that we're investing in some R&D, so focusing on productivity. And then the last issue is the value-adding board. We're challenging all boards right across New Zealand to ask themselves, have we added value today? Because we know that sometimes you can walk away from a board meeting and you go, well, that was great, lots of minutes. Have we added value today? I think we just need to make sure we're focused on the right things, making a difference and adding value.
Productivity is a really, really important one. So at Groove, you know, we went through this whole well-being thing and it was fantastic because I think COVID put to the fore. Post-COVID, we've gone back to bottom line and that sort of stuff. I think well-being is a word that no one really knows what it is because there's so many things out there. What we talk about at Groove is performance care. I personally believe this as well. You're not going to get performance or productivity out of people to their best unless you actually genuinely care for them. And the care word's really, really important. I talk about having a work family and a home family. There's no work-life balance anymore. So you need to make sure that you're caring for those people who spend a lot of time at work. What would your perception of performance care look like? And do you think the care is a big part of actually improving our productivity?
Oh, I love that. I love that concept because, you know, that's also addresses this point or this question we get about, as you mentioned, about post-COVID, we've gone back to bottom line, right? Why are they two separate things? Aren't they actually the same thing? And, you know, if we really want our businesses to do well and to get a better bottom line, then we need discretionary effort from our people, right? So the way that our businesses grow and the way that our customers get a really great experience and the way that we achieve the targets that we're trying to achieve or whatever the, you know, the service, whatever it is that our business is focused on, again, comes back to the people doing a really great job. They're going to care for customers if they feel that they're cared for, you know, and again, it's a little bit 80s, but, you know, the kind of the Branson Virgin example about you know, your staff are your customers, servant leadership, and then they will serve your customers. And, you know, it's a bit of a reflection of my age that I'm kind of probably a bit of a snapshot of that management approach in terms of how I like to approach the management that I bring into the organizations that I lead, that if you support the staff and then they will, you know, then go on to achieve really great things for your organization. So I think it's not a choice between, you know, the performance and the care. And I love that you're bringing those two things together because that is the reality that, you know, I'm of an era as well where, you know, I was lucky enough to have some time working with Sir Brian Lahore, you know, who, you know, that sort of kind of thing that really impacted on me with that quote that better people make better All Blacks, right? So if we develop the person and we care about the person with all of the aspects that go around them and their well-being, and we're interested in their professional development and those aspects, then they will do a better job for us as All Blacks. They will be better All Blacks, and that's better for the organisation, and that has flow-on effects. So that was quite influential for me in terms of kind of developing my leadership approach. And I think, you know, I firmly believe that the approach you're taking on that is exactly where New Zealand business needs to focus.
So there was another pretty influential Kiwi, Sir John Key. I read an article that was written on you that changed or influenced the way you are. I believe that, or you can share the saying because I used to, you've got it in your office somewhere, haven't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. It's actually at the office at work. But yeah, look, it's, you know, I think the people that you're lucky enough to spend some time with, take the best from them, right? You know, and I was having a coaching and mentoring conversation this morning with one of my team, and he'd watched a playback of a video of a meeting that he and I were both in. And he said, oh, you do this, this, and this, but I can't do that. And I'm like, well, you don't have to do that, right? It's take the best of those aspects and make it your own and your own different style and different approach. we're lucky because of the roles that we have that we get to spend some time with some really interesting, influential New Zealanders. One of the things that I like to do is try and share that with other people who perhaps aren't in the same rooms that you and I are in. And yeah, that then I feel that those conversations are, I'm sharing that along the line and passing that through, and time with Sir John Key's part of that.
You said, what was the saying? Service leadership. What's the saying you used?
Servant, yeah, servant leadership,
Sure.
absolutely.
Do you think that that's so? Explain that to me. And do you think that's important? Most people that are going on boards, besides me, have probably come through the whole CEO, been in important roles. Now they're going on to boards. Explain the servant leadership, and do you think it's a fundamental when you then go from possibly the boss to a board role?
Yeah, I think we've seen a shift in what we expect from our leaders, right? I think if we think back to sort of the 1980s kind of model of CEO, the really strong, big alpha, kind of approach. I think our expectations of that have changed. If we think about who the CEOs are that, we admire or, are seen as, popular now, I think they do have a very humanistic approach to their leadership style. So, quite a different style. And I think that's reflective of the challenges and of managing our organizations now. I think it's the expectations of what society expects from us, because there is no, difference between home and life now. What I get up to at home and what I get up to on social media is part of my job now, and the way that I behave, if I'm grumpy with someone at the supermarket, and the way that you behave if you're grumpy at someone, that's all part of our leadership role. There's, that's just who we are as leaders now, and cancel culture and all of that sort of stuff that goes with it. But the servant leadership is about this aspect of if you, that leadership firstly is service, and I firmly believe that, and I think board roles are leadership roles and they are service roles. But that if we, by leading, as opposed to this kind of the hierarchy and control model, there is a place for that. If you're in the army, hierarchy and control, if you've got guns and bullets, command and control is going to be necessary. There will be some circumstances for health and safety where command and control is going to be necessary. But a lot of the time in the organizations where it's about customer service or product or other things, we're actually, if we empower our staff, if the staff are seen as the kind of center of the circle and that they're the, you kind of flip that pyramid up the other way, the bigger group is actually the top of the pyramid. It's not about serving me as the CEO and kind of like I get the best of everything. It's about how do I make sure that I'm serving the staff. They'll then go out and serve the customers. So that's what servant leadership is. It's the kind of model that I try and adopt.
What would be the standing items on a board agenda to make sure that it ensures the focus on this performance care, right? If we believe it's the future, if you're running a board, how do you actually ensure there's a focus on it?
Culture. Absolutely. Now, again, culture is a bit of a really kind of big woolly concept, a bit like well-being. And I think because we kind of use it so much, as you sort of said, well-being, we kind of we slip through it really easy without fully understanding what it means in all of its parts. And culture's a bit the same. But boards need to be having conversations about the culture in the organization. Now, when we say that the tone at the top, and we've often sort of said, well, you need to think about the tone at the top, but boards also need to be thinking about the mood in the middle and the buzz at the bottom. Right. So, what are you doing to be able to get feedback from the organization about how work is actually done around here? How are you getting feedback about the culture and about the leadership and about the management? And, that's about things like staff culture surveys, it's about employee NPS scores, it's about customer feedback surveys, it's about thinking about those measuring customer outcomes. It's about things like getting out of the boardroom, going and walking around and seeing the place, right? Go and talk to people. And don't just do it when they know you're coming. There's this old funny thing that the late Queen used to think that all toilets smelt of fresh paint, right? Because anywhere she went, everyone always painted everything before she got there. You don't want to be like the Queen announcing your visit all the time. If you're in a business that's running retail stores, go to the retail store. Do you shop there? Do you actually pop in and see how things are going? If you're in a business that's running petrol stations, do you actually go at 2 o'clock in the morning sometimes when the person's actually, having to operate in quite different conditions somewhere in Courtney Place on a Friday night at 2 o'clock in the morning than there is at, 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning when the manager's organised for you to go? So think about those kind of things, about how you get out and test those things. Again, trust but verify.
As chairman, how do I look after the well-being of our directors? Because often our boards are looking down and looking about all these things, but it's a pretty stressful situation. So how do I look after the directors?
It's a really great question because actually we've been doing some work, and we did some work with you guys as well about who cares for the directors. And actually, it doesn't seem to be anyone who's legally responsible for the directors. The directors are responsible for the company and responsible for the staff and for everybody else, but there's actually no one responsible for them. So if you think about things like EAP services or those kind of support services, often they don't even cover the board. And yet the board will be the one, if there is a crisis or something happens, where they will have to be stepping in to deal with that issue, and can be just as distressed as the management or others who have been impacted by that particular circumstance. So we've been trying to encourage boards to think about how do they care for their own well-being, to talk about well-being on the board, to make sure that they've got some systems and support structures to do that. We've started asking them how many are doing that. Less than half. It's only in the early 40% of boards that have actually had a conversation about board well-being in the last 12 months, and now recent survey that we did at the end of last year. So there's lots more work to do there. But I think we are seeing, while it's still only less than half of boards, I'd suggest it would probably be less than 10% of boards who had that conversation 20 years ago. So actually even coming into a board meeting and going, things are a bit tricky for me at the moment. I'm struggling a bit, or, I'm not feeling a hundy, or I'm having a health issue, or, actually, I've got a bit of a dark dog at the moment. I don't think we could have those conversations a while ago. So now even just talking about that much more openly is making a shift, but still much more work to go.
How do it? So KP and JK, we're on a board together and we're really passionate about this performance care stuff. How do you make sure it gets driven down through the organization if it is the will or the want of the board and you have the CEO in between? Is that a problem? How do we do that?
Well, boards recruit the CEO, right? So, when we talk about that tone at the top, the most important decision that you will make as a board is who do you recruit as your CEO to be your representative? So, I firmly believe that CEOs are for a season. You've got to match the right person up to the right time. I applied for the IOD CEO role before I got this role. The first time round, a few years before, I didn't get the job. I didn't even get an interview with the board. And so the second time round, when I got asked to apply for the job this time, I said no, because I was, ego comes into play, and I was all pissy because, you didn't want me last time, so I'm not gonna apply for the job and let you kind of put me through that process again. But I was encouraged to go into it, and here I am in the role. And I actually think it was for the right time. Actually, the last season, I wasn't right for where they were and what they were wanting to achieve, but I was right this time. So you've got to pick the right CEO for the right time. And if you've got, look, one of the things I get concerned about is organizations sort of saying one thing and doing another. And the way that happens is if they say they're all about performance care, for example, but then actually they hire a CEO who is all about the performance and not about the care. Or if you are the CEO in the middle of that, whereas the board's saying we're about performance care, but they only ever ask me about performance. So one of the things I try and encourage for the boards I get to speak to, but also the people in management that I get to lead, and when I'm sort of developing or coaching and mentoring people, it was something that one of my very early mentors, Daryl Bellamy, passed on to me, and that's really stuck with me, is that Think about the questions you are asking the most. So if I say to you that I am about here, and that's what I say, and I'm out in the front, talking about that, but then the only questions I ever ask you are solely about performance and why haven't you hit your targets and what's happening with these sales and bottom line is not improving and you need to, go faster, go harder, this is not good enough. The care stuff clearly is not important. And I will respond to what your questions are. So the questions we ask and the leaders that we recruit, the standard that we walk past is the standard that we accept. If we are not dealing with performance issues, if we're not dealing with ethics and integrity issues and about cultural issues, then that's how we will set the tone through the organization. So the leaders that we recruit are incredibly important.
You spoke before, and lovely sweatshirt you've got on, because I know you're involved in organizations like Voices of Hope and the Wellington Homelands Women's Trust. It demonstrates a commitment, right, to community initiatives. Do you think it's essential for businesses to be engaged and support their local communities? And I know you said that we trust our businesses more than we do our governments now. So you think that's a fundamental part also of what the board should stand for?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think it's, every business will do that in a slightly different way, right? Do I think that every business should be supporting a charity? That's how I'm kind of wired, and that's what, from a values perspective, that suits for me. But that may not be the right fit for every organization. And, for some people, they'll be involved in some community activities, and for others, they'll be working really hard to grow, their family wealth, and then they donate to charity. That's an okay answer too, depending upon what your priorities and things are. But again, back to that issue of trust and about the expectation of our communities and societies, we're expecting more from business now. We're expecting people to come back to purpose. So at the IOD, we have this kind of our big kind of governance book that everyone best practice guide. It's called the Four Pillars, and the very first pillar is about purpose. And so, and there's a reason why it's number one. What is the purpose of the organization? And people are looking to want to work for organizations or are wanting to have a customer relationship with organizations that have a greater purpose, right? So, what is your approach to, engaging with the environment? What is your approach to be thinking about social issues and how transparent and ethical are you as an organization? And there is huge opportunities for the private sector to be connecting with our not-for-profit or for-purpose sector, depending upon, because we might not be for profit, but we're also not for loss. Not-for-profits do still need to kind of pay the bills. So, there is huge opportunities to be able to connect opportunities between those two organizations, whether it's talent, whether it's resources, whether it's people donating their time and supporting charities. But our community needs are just so huge, and we've got amazing, amazing not-for-profits out there doing some really, really great work to help fill in some of those gaps that government just can't fill.
Okay, here's a question for you. JK's listened to this podcast and he's thinking, wow, I want to get on a board. I'm going to aspire to get on a board and be a director. Where do you start? What do you do? What does IOD offer? How do I go about this?
Yeah, there's some information on our website about how to sort of get started in governance and, what the basics of all of that are. But the first thing is follow your passion. Most of us start our governance roles in not-for-profit land, right? So in an area, whether it's our school boards of trustees or whether it's a sports club or something that we're involved in. I started my governance career at Plunkett. I was involved in the local Plunkett committee and sort of moved through my time at Plunkett and then got involved in initiatives around my kids' sport. So, my son's a rugby player, and so I've spent sort of 10 years working at the New Zealand Rugby Foundation on their board as a charity supporting seriously injured rugby players to make sure, to try and make the game as safe as possible and that there's really great support around people in the event that there are accidents or life after rugby for them. So, getting involved in different things. My work with Voices of Hope is again a really strong family connection for me, and I really love the work that they do. And you know, mental health is something that we all have, and we just don't talk about enough. And sharing really positive stories about lived experience of mental health is really critical, I feel. So find something that you're passionate about, where you want to spend some discretionary time. Inevitably, those early roles come at night and the weekends on top of your other jobs and fitting around all your stuff. So you've got to care about it. But reach out to charities and not-for-profits, and reach out to businesses and say, hey, I've got some skills, can I help? And usually they will absolutely try and grab you up, because they're always looking for good people to help them out.
What's the most, after all this experience and stuff, what's been the most valuable lesson you've learned about leadership and governance?
It's about the people, absolutely. And that kind of feels a little bit twee. Particularly, here in New Zealand, we say that a lot, he tangata, he tangata, he tangata. And but it's real and it's true, right? I was lucky enough to work with the late Craig Norgate. He was on the board at New Zealand Rugby. He was the first CEO of Fonterra, and I worked with him really closely on a number of mergers and acquisitions. It was an absolute masterclass. But he passed far too early at 50. So, incredibly young. But one of the things that he used to say that really, again, I've sort of taken forward, was that you can only progress as far and as fast as the people you develop underneath you, because you stand on their shoulders. So, if you want to be a manager, then you've got to develop the people around you to be able to step up to the management role. If you want to be the next level manager, then again, if you're being dragged down into all of the operational issues and your team can't survive without you and they need you to make every decision, you're never going to be able to be released to be able to get up to the next level. So he tangata, he tangata, he tangata, the people. And we know that if we develop great people, there'll be better outcomes.
So I'm coming at you now, KP. I'm coming at you. So how do you maintain a healthy work-life balance? We talk about the six pillars. I live by them. Six
Yeah.
pillars of well-being. So I just call it my daily mental health plan. So there's six of them, and I'm going to ask you each one of them and see how you respond. So how
Yeah,
do you do it?
I'm gonna squirm at some of them, absolutely, but that's why this is a great conversation, right? Because hopefully someone will learn from my very bad example.
So how do you chill? Chill for me is switching off my brain. I've got a monkey brain, so to do that, I have to disengage my brain. I'm an active relaxer, so I sort of read, play the guitar, cook. How do you chill?
Yeah, I'm an introvert. So a lot of people are surprised to hear that about me, because they kind of see you on stage doing stuff or bits and pieces or in the media, but that's not how I get my energy at all. And I really don't enjoy public speaking. I have to kind of get myself up to be able to do it, and then I find it really adrenaline depleting. So the chill one is really, really important for me. I need to kind of retreat to my cave. So chill for me, cup of tea with a book and a cat. So that's kind of Which and I live in a house with one cat and three dogs. So, and I live in a house with three other extroverts. They're the dog people, right? So the cat and I are kind of hiding with our book, kind of going, I need some space out in my own head, give myself, that kind of recovery time.
How do you connect?
I love people in small groups, but I'm really bad in big groups. So I find really large networking events really difficult, but I love meeting people and I love connecting with people in smaller groups. So smaller one-to-one, and I really make sure that I reach out to a couple of my really good friends daily. That's a really important part for me.
What do you do? So, for example, I explain do as something that's outside work. For example, I'm trying to learn how to read music. So that's my,
Wow.
yeah. When you talk about do, we've worked out that it's really good for neuroplasticity and very, very good for your mental health if you're doing something to improve your brain. So what are you doing in the do?
Yeah. When you do all those kind of assessments about what your strengths are and all that sort of stuff, and your Myers-Briggs and things. So one of the things that comes through really, really strongly for me is a learner for life. So I'm constantly wanting to learn about all sorts of different things, and I'll go down all sorts of kind of rabbit warrens on things. And I set myself kind of a theme for the year of things that I'm learning about for that year. And so last year it was about hydrogen and climate, because I knew not I'm not a scientist, I knew nothing about hydrogen, but I wanted to kind of don't ask me any questions. I still don't think I understand it, but I gave myself a permission to explore a whole pile of things. This year, it's actually about I'm trying to understand AI a bit more. So I've been on a went on a 2-day training course on AI. I'm going to sit an exam to become a certified AI governance professional. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm kind of doing and exploring in that space. So, and then on the other hand, my brain really loves crafts. So, and so I like doing things like scrapbooking and card making and all those really old mumsy type things
Good for your
because
mental.
it's a physical thing and my brain likes the creativity.
It's really good for your mental health. That's a, you know, I read an article the other day that knitting is very good for your mental health. Now, you are self-confessed non sort of sports person who worked for the NZR. I read that in an article, but how do you move? How do you, and this is really, really important for people who are listening. You know, we get all this stuff thrown at us. We get all these diets thrown at us. Anyone who throws something fitness, they always look perfect, right? This is about that. This is about moving in your day to make sure that what you need to.
Exactly. So this is the one where I'd say do what I say and not what I do for sure, because I spent the last kind of 3 years stress eating COVID biscuits, right? So, but a couple of things. I have a standing desk. So that's a really important way for me to get incidental exercise. That's one of the things I found during COVID really difficult because I didn't have a standing desk at home. So one of the things I've invested in is a standing desk at home because that's really good. And I really regret early on and when I was younger, not getting involved in more team sport activities that could actually continue on into my adult years. So for me, when I was younger, I did Highland dancing and ballet. Well, that's not something you're going to do as a 50 mumble mumble year old, right? So they were great when I was younger, but not really great for me now. But the one thing that I do is walking. So I do a lot of walking. As I said, three dogs. So that's, we're a family that likes to get out, and I've got really, really active kids doing a real range of two kids doing a range of sports activities, but yeah, getting out and walking. But it's something I need to do more, particularly in the roles that we've got, because I do a lot of travel. I'm away from home a lot. I don't always get to choose what I eat because we'll be at functions or dinners or other things. It all sounds nice and wonderful until actually you're trying to make some good choices. You just want a home cooked meal. And you're in a strange city in the middle of nowhere, and you don't feel like going for a walk because it's late at night. So yeah, that's probably my focus for 2024.
How do you celebrate?
I'm a pretty optimistic person, actually. So lots of celebrations and celebrating the small things. We had a family dinner last night for my husband's immediate family. There were 16 of us for St. Patrick's Day, right?
Beautiful.
So we had a couple of, wear a bit of green, made some green raro, green jelly, green ice cream, everyone, sort of three generations coming together to sort of bring family together and celebrate some of those things. Just celebrate the little things. My husband's a funeral director. It's an unusual job, but what we learn from that is that you celebrate every day and celebrate the small things.
What do you enjoy on a daily basis?
Oh, my family. My learning and yeah, I just enjoy life really. Just enjoy the good and the small things. Sometimes it'll be a cup of tea. Sometimes it'll be driving to work and having a break from the kids. Sometimes it's coming home from work. So yeah, and when all else fails, sometimes it'll just be 5 minutes out, and sometimes it's chocolate.
Beautiful. Amy, that's been amazing. When I do these, I write notes. So I'm just going to throw some stuff back at you that I've heard and written down. So we're talking about boards and governance now. Trust but verify. Ask good questions. Diversity is better for business. Diverse board with different skills. So that's meaning get your board people around you that will be able to satisfy what the direction you're going. Some things to be very conscious of at the moment: A, cybersecurity, which New Zealand isn't that good at the moment. The other four or five things you told me: climate, leadership is really, really important. Future ready succession. So what do we need to look like in the future? AI at the moment, what is the board's doing? Because that looks like, what are you doing about productivity? And then we went into the performance care conversation, important to look after people. And you've got to be a value-added board. The other things that I really liked that I just wrote down for me to take away was Service leadership, what does that look like? And I'm going to ask myself that question. What's the mood in the middle? That got me thinking as well. But what's the buzz at the bottom? I thought that was great to think about. And, when you think about some of the big boards these people are on, and how are you getting feedback? So how are you actually realizing that that's going to the top? KP, thanks for your time. You're always awesome.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
I know you're busy, but that's been amazing. I've learned some stuff. I'm better for it. So from a selfish point of view, thank you.
Yeah, fantastic. No, it's always great to catch up, and thanks for the amazing work that you're doing.
Yeah, keep doing what you're doing. We'll catch up soon.
Fantastic.
Ciao.
Ka kito.
Thank you for joining us on Open Minded. To keep up with each episode, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on social media at GrooveNow or groovenow.com. With Groove, we're bringing performance care to the world of work and beyond. Stay well, and I look forward to sharing more with you next time.